Jeff Blair loves to commute. Let him join you on yours. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. On demand. On demand. On demand. When you have an opinion to express, we'll give you a place to have it shot down. This is Joey Vendetta on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Joey Vendetta back 2 minutes after. Actually, it's now 3 minutes after. If you're one of those nitpicky people, and we know you are out there. Is it going to rain today? Well, it rained this morning. We're going to get some thunderstorms tonight to alleviate this humidity. 31 degrees tomorrow. Beautiful. Beautiful. I recommend you go to work in a Speedo. And you can borrow the one that Ryan Lochte won't be wearing because Speedo dumped his American ass. No more endorsements for Ryan Lochte. What about Hope Solo? We're going to take some more Blue Jay calls, by the way. Marco Estrada. Getting roughed up last night. Had some good stuff. He was pitching well. Right? Six pitches to get through the third. Listen, Albert Pujols, man, he's still a beast. I know he's got 5 years left on his deal or whatever it is. If Cole Calhoun doesn't ground that curveball just past Edwin at first for a double that drives in a run, to start things off. You know, they Jays then walk Mike Trout with runners on second and third. But Albert comes up. I mean, do you ever think that you would want to pitch to Albert Pujols? When they did that, I was thinking to myself, huh? Really? Okay. Then CJ Cron hits a two-strike, two-out fastball into right field, and it's 5-0. Sayonara, arrivederci, domo, ori freaking gato. Let's see if we can get back on track tonight. Jose Bautista should be in the lineup. And Devin Travis, you would hope, is going to be in the lineup. I mean, he got injected in his knuckle. He had a knuckle issue. But again, he uses his hands. Jared Weaver on the mound. Righty against righty. Actually, righty against lefty because Jay Happ's pitching tonight going for his 18th win. Remember when they signed Jay Happ and you were, huh? What? He's terrible. Yeah, I know he was good in Pittsburgh, but they have a great pitching coach there. Yeah, he's 17-3 with an ERA just over 3. We will be joined by John Angelos, John P. Angelos, from the Baltimore Orioles and the Mid-Atlantic Sports Network, one of the smartest media experts that you will find. The phone lines are jammed. We love having you contribute to the program. 416-870-0590. 1-888-666-0590. Make the show better. Come with intelligence. Come with irreverence. Come with controversy. We're happy to hear it all. On Twitter, at Radio Vendetta. We were talking about the TFC earlier. I know many of you are, why do we talk about TFC? They're in first place, that's why. And they play in a sport that draws 30,000 people. Period. That's why. Don Baxter, TFC is fine, but MLS is like the CFL compared to the NFL. Yeah, people go to CFL games too. And by the way, when the NFL was in Toronto, played the games at the Rogers Center, not that many people went. Norman James, CTV, educate, son, hashtag TFC forever. Here's a real soccer topic. Why is League MLS yet the names are FC? Because they're football clubs. I'm not even going to say that that was Gary Cook, who's a prolific tweeter. At Lucas Colangelo, nice to hear someone on the fan talk about TFC and give them some attention. Well, Dan Riccio talks about him a lot. He has a podcast. Greg Vanny's always on. I'm going to try and get Altidore Vanny on the show tomorrow. They deserve it. Javinko had 2 assists last night. Guy's so good. So fun to watch. And Flint17 says, thank you for giving TFC the credit they deserve. Raheem Samji. I walked away for 4 minutes. I want more TFC talk. And someone tweets in that they tried to get tickets and that it was sold out. Someone tweets in about the Krause trade. Arizona and Florida working on a deal that will send Dave Bolin and Lawson Krause to the Coyotes for a second and third pick, basically trying to dump Bolin's contract. Still got, what does he have left, 4 years? Remember, Leaf fans, when you were worried that Dave Bolin, I love Dave Bolin, he's a friend of mine. But God bless him, he got that deal. Oh, and he's a great hockey player. When he plays, he gets hurt. When he plays, he's still great, still gritty. He's annoying. He's obnoxious, which is what you want on the ice. Let's go to Mark in Bethany. Mark, Estrada's outing last night. Blue Jays tied for first with the Red Sox. Baltimore wins last night. They're only a game back. Are you concerned?
Okay, I'm not concerned about our pitching. I think Estrada has a back problem. Hopefully he irons it out. But, you know, Estrada, he was our hero last year. You remove Estrada, we didn't get into the playoffs. I mean, he came in two outings and he saved our ass. So hopefully he gets better. And when Sanchez comes back, I'm not a big fan of the six-man rotation. But what concerns me is we're not hitting like a World Series team. I mean, you look at some of the teams we've been playing lately, very low-scoring games against average pitchers. And, you know, last night, we should have, you know, hit the ball a lot, and we weren't. And so, you know, unless we get, you know, our pitchers can't win the games for us. Our hitters have to win the games for us as well.
It's one of those games, and thanks for the call. It's one of those games that you just, let's forget it. Let's move on. Toronto's offense was shut down by Matt Shoemaker. He three-hit the Jays. He had six scoreless innings. There was really, you know, when Josh Donaldson led off with a single and Edwin walked behind him and then Donaldson got the third, that was really it. There wasn't much else going on. And look, Estrada has a rough outing. He was hard on himself, and he said he thinks that the additional rest has zero consequences on his performance. It was just the Angels hit him. Sometimes guys that know how to hit. And the Angels, as bad as they've been, still have some very good players on their team. And tonight's another example. Jared Weaver has been a great pitcher in the past. So let's not look past Jared Weaver, despite the fact that Jay Happ's on the mound and he's got more wins than anybody on the staff. Let's take another call before we get to John Angelos here. Let's go to Mike in Niagara Falls. Mike, 10 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. How are you on this Thursday?
I'm fine, Joey. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Two quick comments, one on the Jays and one on TFC.
Sure.
I think MLS has evolved and is getting stronger because they got rid of most of the diving that North American sports fans couldn't stand in soccer or football. And also, you see a lot more players coming this way than going the other way, which FIFA anticipated MLS being like a farm system. Well, it's not quite happening that way. And I don't think you'll see as much fixing in the games because a Congress in the States that won't stand for it. They'll put their butts in jail. So you aren't going to get so much fixing like there is worldwide in the corrupt FIFA.
It's entertaining. Listen, bottom line on it, is when you get guys like, whether it's Robbie Keane or Javinko, it's if you look at the quality of players and David Villa, you know, guys that we, you know, Steven Gerrard, the names go on and on. There's names that we know, and at some point, you know, Ronaldo might come here,
right?
Like these guys are looking at MLS. That's what you got to remember now, sports fans. MLS is no longer the redheaded stepchild that when you're on your last legs and you're 38 years old, you take as a payday. So we got John Angelos on hold here. Let's just wrap up your call. You wanted to talk about the Jays real quick? Okay, I think we lost the caller. All right, our apologies. Let's go to John Angelos now. He runs the Mid-Atlantic Sports Network, the Baltimore Orioles. He's an old pal. We love having him on the program. John, thanks for doing this. How are you today?
I'm good today, Joey. How are you? Good morning.
Yeah, the Jays fans are not good today, John. They lost last night. Estrada had a rough outing. You guys won, but you got some bad news. And before we talk media and the digital impact, because there was actually a very interesting article in the New York Times on the way sports fans consume media. Chris Tillman's been put on the 15-day DL. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Chris has some apparent shoulder inflammation, and that our training staff and Buck are watching his progress, and we're hopeful that he'll that Chris will not miss too many starts. But I don't think that I don't think we know much more beyond that right now. So we're hopeful Chris will just miss the sort of mandatory two starts, and we'll be back with us, because we rely on him a lot.
Yeah, you do, and you got Ubaldo Jimenez, who's not had a great year, going tonight. I think he realizes the responsibility that is being put on his shoulders. He's facing Max Scherzer, and you guys have done pretty well against the Nats these last couple of games. And your bullpen, despite the fact that Zach Britton saw his record run end last night, has been pretty incredible this season, and your hitting's been incredible. And despite the starting pitching situation, you guys are still right there. And man, talk about how competitive the AL East is. It's just incredible that it's been a dogfight the entire season.
Yeah, it has. And it was for a long, long time very tilted towards the two clubs. And now it's really good, I think, for the fans to see different clubs and a few more than two competing, because for a variety of reasons things have evened out a little bit, and you've got a different mix. So that's been good, but it looks like it's going to go right down to the wire, and could be any one of three or maybe even four clubs. So that's pretty cool.
All right, I want to talk about the consumption of sports media. You run the Mid-Atlantic Sports Network, which is on, and if I'm not mistaken, you can correct me, seven states? Am I right, or is it eight?
It's six states plus the District of Columbia,
right?
so jurisdictions.
Yeah, so I give the District of Columbia way too much credit. That's the bottom line here, as a state.
well, right, and they would say that the U.S. Congress gives them way too little credit, because they don't have senators and all the rest of that stuff.
Exactly.
So you're right.
Yeah, I knew why you were laughing, by the way, when I said that. So let's discuss. There was an article in the New York Times in talking about how the sports media gets consumed, and it's interesting. Television broadcasters are kind of starting to view their content the way the rest of us do. It's something that you watch, and it doesn't really matter where you watch it anymore, because more and more, especially we hear the buzzword millennials, as we try to reach these people as broadcasters. How have you seen the consumption of sports media change in the last several years? I know the last couple of years has been incredible, but in the last, say, 10 years, it's changed incredibly.
Well, one way it's changing, at least from two perspectives. I mean, when you think about, there's the consumer viewpoint, and then there's sort of the industry standpoint. And I'm sure there are others, but to make it really simplistic, and I know that years ago, a lot of us inside in the industry, and particularly in baseball, but I think it was across the board, viewed things in terms of what device people were using, or what platform people were using, and try to divide the world up into, well, who has control over which devices or what platforms, and what information is going to go on what platforms or what devices. And I think people have seen that that's all sort of passé, but it's really just about the content, and that all the devices all the devices and all the platforms have really become converged, and each can substitute for one another. And once that's happened, really all you're thinking about is how to get access to all these different groups. There was a lot of talk about how 5 and 10 years ago, even maybe a little less, that how one device or one platform was going to overwhelm the other one, sort of the way that Uber has to some extent overwhelmed traditional taxis, right? But I think people have started to realize that that's not happening. That if you look at the Nielsen ratings and you look at the quarterly Nielsen eyeballs, it isn't the case that people viewing on tablets or people viewing on mobile phones have completely
overtaken or replaced television sets, that they're all sort of complementary and they're all really converged. So that's one change. And I think that's really been dictated by the consumer, because people thought that mobile would take over completely. Some people did. Well, there's an interesting book out called Television is the New Television. And it's really about the opposite point of view, that digital networks are becoming more like traditional ones. The Netflix, as an example, on the video side, is moving back from away from a digital only to more of a potentially one day soon might become more like an HBO, for example, whereas an HBO moved from a traditional platform to more of a digital platform. So they're sort of all meeting in the middle is, I think, more the prevailing view.
Okay, and as a guy that runs a network, how do you deal with this? Is it just we create the content and put it on every platform, or do you customize content for each platform and try to make it unique to the platform?
Well, it's interesting to ask me that because our principal content at the Mid-Atlantic Sports Network is baseball, televising two baseball teams and 300 games. Now we televise another, say, 200 live events of NCAA basketball, football, women's sports, all kinds of diverse stuff. But the reason that we exist is because of the baseball. You mentioned the AL East and the Orioles are in that division and the Nats are in the NL East. And that's why our network exists, because of all those high profile teams and those divisions that those two teams play. But one of the interesting things that's gone on in baseball over the last decade is that baseball kind of carved out a specific approach to digital that was different from all the other sports leagues. And I think different from all the other content creators and distributors in television, film, as well as sports, where baseball took a completely different approach and tried to sequester the digital world into the league and leave television to the individual clubs. And what that resulted in many respects was really the fact that the content wasn't getting out on a digital platform for, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years when it probably could have. So a lot of kids didn't see the games on the mobile platform and on their tablets and their laptops because of the approach baseball took. And now that's starting to change, and finally young people and older people alike are starting to be able to see the stuff streamed, all the live game content streamed on these other platforms, but they were really denied it for a long time. So I didn't have to make that much of that decision. I'm looking forward to being able to make that decision soon as baseball's finally sort of figuring out we got to get all our games out on all our platforms and devices and not be worrying about these sort of abstract delineations that don't apply.
At John P. Angelos, if you want to follow him on Twitter, 20 minutes after 10 o'clock, on this Thursday, August the 25th, runs the Mid-Atlantic Sports Network and the Baltimore Orioles, along with his dad and his brother. And John is a guy that is at the forefront of the way media works in sports and talks to a bunch of people about it and goes to all kinds of conferences and seminars and speaks on the subject. And I think going forward, John, to your point, MLB was – it's interesting because MLB, Advanced Media, which you and I have discussed – ad nauseum, off the air and on the air, has been so much at the forefront on so many levels and gets credit for so many things. And yet, on other things, it's been kind of archaic. And it's interesting because, you know, certainly you look at in sports, for example, some hockey teams that have had to do it. And I'll use the LA Kings as an example. Before they won the Stanley Cup, before they became Stanley Cup contenders, they embraced their fans that were communal online. And you know this because I'm sure you have tons of them with the Orioles, where there are Baltimore Orioles fans who have their own websites and their own blogs and their own communities. And many sports teams four-walled their digital endeavors and didn't allow these fans to interface. And then I remember the Kings, I think, were the first ones to do it, where there were all these bloggers that people that, you know, and I guess this is the problem with quote unquote journalism and why some university journalism programs have gone the way of the dinosaur in that they've been eliminated. And because true journalism in terms of trained journalism, it's now all about clicks and clickbait. And to bring the point back around, LA I remember they did this before they made the playoffs, and they embraced these communities and actually put them on their own website and allowed these people to become official, unofficial parts of the team. How do you approach that type of thing? How do you approach those types of communities?
Well, you know, that, it's interesting you say that because you mentioned the other leagues. And I think if you go back to 2000, think about the, you know, the world of pre-Y2K, you know, and really the just after the dot-com bubble, there was just a lot of there was some understandable, I guess, fear, anxiety about what the digital world would bring. And if you go back 16 years from this conversation.
John, by the way, John, do you know how much money I spent preparing for Y2K and nothing happened?
Did you really spend any money preparing for Y2K?
No, but I worked at Disney at the time, and they sure spent a hell of a lot of money on it.
No question about that. Right. Well, see, there's a good example. There's a super sophisticated, not that you and I aren't super sophisticated
oh,
as well.
Are you kidding me? But, I'm wearing cufflinks right now.
I'm not touching that. Yeah. Wearing cufflinks. Okay. Comment, right. So you know, unlike you and I who are modestly sophisticated, Disney's a super sophisticated digital company. Yet even a company like a Disney can at that time, and I'm sure at other times, have a focus that maybe turns out to be not all that accurate. There was a lot of concern about, you know, digital and what digital was going to be. And it was very unknown, and it was going to be this great interrupter. And that did lead all the leagues to sequester, four wall, as you say, their content. But the problem with that, and then later MLB went a lot further in doing that, and the content didn't really get out for a long, long time. I mean, as I said, the better part of a decade when the technology existed and there were networks clamoring, you know, an ESPN or a Fox or what have you, were clamoring, you know, to get content out. And this was going on to some extent in the NBA and the NHL too.
Are you talking about older games or just current games? Like archival footage?
No, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because things like condensed games, which are a great thing, you know, if you wake up in, you know, 6 a.m. and you're commuting and you want to watch a 20, 30 minute condensed game or from the night before, that's a great thing to have, a great service to be able to deliver by a TV network or a digital, you know, a delivery. But classic games, replayed games really have such a fractional number of eyeballs watching them. What really drives the sports and the interest and the value on the media side is live games. So I'm really talking, Joey, about live games.
Sure,
you gotta get live games out on all platforms. And really the leagues weren't doing that for a long, long time. And then people started to sort of realize, wait, we got to do something about this. The NBA and the NHL, for instance, were charging a per-game rate to their regional sports networks. If the regional sports networks, wanted to stream an NBA game or an NHL game in their local network, well, that was the wrong answer. And what baseball was doing in many respects was also the wrong answer for many years. Why? Because when you've got $7, $8, $9, or $10 billion leagues, what are those leagues based on? They're based on ticket sales largely. They're based on live event sales and significant media sales. You need to get incremental media sales from getting the digital content out, live games I'm talking about primarily, with some replays and encores and condensed and all of that. And you need to get the content out in order to drive more affinity for your live event. So if you're a kid in upstate New York and you're a Yankees or Mets fan, or you might even be a Red Sox fan if you live in the eastern part of New York, you can't get to the stadium but a handful of times. You need to see Yankees and Mets games on your tablet and your cell phone. You've got to have access to those games every single game so that hopefully you come to a Yankees game an extra time or an extra two times, or you ask your parents to take the trip down, you know, 2 or 3 hours and take you to the stadium. So that's why content really has to be out there on every platform and every device uninterrupted. But I think leagues got distracted over many years and said, this digital thing might be bigger. This new business might be bigger than our existing business. And that's turned out to really not be the case. The new business, the new revenue stream is not bigger than the traditional revenue stream. And sometimes you have to just focus on the business you're in and not so much focus on other things. I think that's the lesson that was learned in sports, because we're about eyeballs and we're about live attendance as well as media. Can't sort of sacrifice one for the other.
John Angelos is our guest. We're going to wrap up really quickly, John. We got about a minute. You bring up a very good point, whereas it seemed to be for a minute, or maybe a longer minute or a hot minute, the teams, the leagues, were convinced that the digitization of the content was going to be far more lucrative than maybe it is. Is that fair?
Well, I think that's definitely fair. I mean, you know, there's also a question of what business are you in at a certain point? You know, what business are these leagues in? Are they technology providers first and foremost, or at all? Like, I mean, they can certainly diversify into those businesses if they choose, and there might be some value there. Very well may be. But at the end of the beginning and end of the day, you're about growing interest in your sport. And the way you grow interest in your sport is keeping your nose to the grindstone on making fans more interested in the sport of hockey, the league of the NHL, watching the games of the NHL, and attending the events of the NHL, to use a hockey example. That applies in baseball, football, basketball. That doesn't change because a new digital platform came along, and that's still where your bread is buttered. Whether you're a $4 or $5 billion industry like hockey, basketball, or you're a $10 or $11 billion industry like football, or you know, $9 or so billion, let's say, in the baseball example, you got to keep your eye on that. And I think leagues sort of, for the 15 years ago concerns, got a little bit distracted, and now they're starting to come back to that and realize, as you say, that you know, the digital isn't what some people said it was going to be.
John, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Very insightful, very, very, very knowledgeable stuff for people that are into media. And we know that in this day and age, more and more fans are. But at the end of the day, as you said, it's really about attending the events. And you've been to the Rogers Center. You've seen it. I know you have a longtime relationship with Mark Shapiro, his ties to Baltimore. Blue Jays are drawing 40,000 plus pretty much every game, and I think they're fourth in the league in attendance. And you guys get creative with ticket selling, and the Jays have done that. And I know that that's pretty much where, as much as TV revenue is incredibly important, and it's, I'll say, maybe you can answer this question. Is television revenue as important or more important than gate revenue?
It depends on the sport.
Sure.
If in the NFL, where you've got 75%, let's say, just to throw out an approximate, of your revenue coming through the league office, and a quarter of it being generated by the individual clubs in their local markets, the biggest portion of that 75% is media revenue, because the NFL is a low volume, higher price game.
Sure.
Not a lot of games and a high price point. Baseball is the opposite of football. With a very high volume, lot of games, and low, very accessible price point. So in baseball, live events is still king, still dominates. We still got the substantial part of our revenues coming from the local clubs, not from the league administrative office. And we've got most of all of our revenues coming from live events. But we still have significant multi-billion-dollar media revenues. It's just that ticketing dominates. Hockey and basketball are somewhere between the two leagues. And that's sort of the way that you know, you can sort of look across a continuum. But it just depends sort of what your model is. But either way, you know, you've got – and Rogers, obviously. You mentioned Rogers. You mentioned Mark, who was a longtime classmate of mine. And I think I'm not excited about going up against Mark Shapiro as you know, running the Jays, because I think he's going to do a good job there. But when I look at a sophisticated company like Rogers, who was streaming games and doing a lot of good stuff, you know, they clearly realize that they're all connected, that they're driving the digital – in order to pump up those live events. And that's what you're seeing now with the Jays, run well baseball side, good up to the baseball ops, and also a sophisticated content distributor that's driving people to the games. And I think so far, it looks, at least from my perspective, I'm not there, but it seems like the recipe's working pretty well, you know, in Toronto.
And there's that word again, sophistication. I'm going to check Mark Shapiro's cufflinks the next time I see him. Thanks for doing this, pal.
All right, man. Good to talk to you.
We'll talk to you soon. At John P. Angelos on Twitter, runs the Mid-Atlantic Sports Network, Baltimore Orioles. And as you heard, he knows a hell of a lot about sports media, more than anyone I've ever met, actually. And I've met a lot of people. It's 10:31. We're going to come back next with a guy who has won two Super Bowls as the general manager on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
This is Greg Vanney from Toronto FC, and you're listening to Joey Vendetta on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Joining us now is the general manager of the Pittsburgh Steelers. He's won a couple of Super Bowls. He's been doing this a long time, and he is a frequent guest of the show. Thanks for doing this. We welcome Kevin Colbert. Kevin, how are you today?
Doing great, Joey. How about yourself?
I'm fantastic. It's great to have you on the show. We love having you on the program. You offer so much insight on so many levels, and the Steelers have had a long history of diversity with the Rooney Rule, named after Dan Rooney, the owner of your team, and Mike Tomlin, your head coach, is black. I've always wondered, the importance of diversity can't be overstated. I'm curious on your viewpoint, considering how close you are to it. You hired Mike Tomlin. Can you talk about that for us?
Really, the hiring process, you know, Mr. Rooney was very, you know, involved with establishing, you know, fair hiring processes throughout the National Football League. Of course, the Rooney Rule started with the coaches, and it was just to give minorities the same opportunities that others had enjoyed. And, you know, it was something that he believed in, we believed in, and really it's a shame that we have to have that type of urging in today's world. But Mr. Rooney felt it was necessary, and I believe it has worked. In Coach Tomlin's case, you know, Coach Tomlin was someone that caught our eye as a young, up-and-rising coordinator. And, you know, when you look back on the Steelers' history, they had had success hiring young defensive coordinators, both Chuck Knoll and Coach Bill Cowher coming from that vein. So really, they did the organization did nothing different. It just happened to be that Mike was a minority. But really, we weren't fulfilling any type of rule. Because we actually, you know, we interviewed two minorities. And, of course, Ron Rivera was the other one. And, of course, Ron has gone on to have a great career as well. So I think, you know, both Ron and Mike and, you know, Coach Dungy, I mean, there are minority guys that have had great success in this league. And I just think it's, you know, we have to be open to making sure that we're including a minority, especially at the lower level, because these guys have to come from somewhere. You know, they're not just created head coaches. So if we're having the same type of hiring policies at the lower levels for assistant coaches and coordinators, naturally it'll flow into the head coaching world.
You've been with the Steelers for 17 years, first as director of football ops, then as general manager. How has talent assessment evolved over that time?
You know, it really hasn't changed in our opinion. You know, we're still looking for good players that are healthy and good citizens. Sometimes the good player part doesn't work out to our expectations. Sometimes we get surprised by an injury, or a player will suffer an injury once we get them. And then the character stuff will come back and get you every once in a while because, you know, the guys you believe to be good guys, maybe they had some challenges we didn't know about or give enough credence to. But really, it hasn't changed. You know, there's a lot of buzz about analytics and their role in our world, and we acknowledge that, and we use analytics to a certain extent, but I don't think analytics will ever replace the actual play of the player and the character makeup of the player. The things you can't measure, I think, are still the most important. And, you know, again, we'll utilize analytics, and it's big in this world. But as I remind our scouts, look, there's no shortcuts to doing this. There might be a better way to look at data and a quicker way, but you still have to go through the process to make sure we make as good a decision as possible.
And when you say there's no shortcut, Kevin, are you saying putting in the work as a scout and actually going to see the players in person as opposed to using data and watching film?
Yeah, exactly, Joey. I mean, you can look at data and say, okay, this player gets so many yards per catch, so many yards after a catch, whatever. And that's all well and good. But, you know, I want to know, how does he react on the sidelines during a game when he gets a touchdown or he drops a pass or he throws an interception? What's the human element of it? You know, I challenge our analytics people. I say, you know, show me a way to measure the intangibles, and then, you know, you'll really catch my attention, because I don't think that'll ever replace or be lost in our evaluations, because this is still a sport that's played by humans with human emotions, and emotions are really a big, big part of our game. And boy, you got to be careful not to minimize that. Again, they have their place in this evaluation process, but they'll never overtake the human judgment, in my opinion.
Our guest is Kevin Colbert, general manager of the Pittsburgh Steelers. And you talk about emotion. Your defense is pretty young right now, and you were third in sacks, fifth against the run, and surrendered under 20 points a game. You've got some young guys that are pretty emotional. You drafted Ryan Shazier, Bud Dupree. They're both 22. Jarvis Jones is only 25. How are you going to integrate some of the younger players in the secondary before we talk about the linebackers, which look pretty good? I mean, it's pretty young outside of William Gay, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, we don't know who the 22 starters will be at this point, but if it shapes up like we think it will, we'll only have three or four 30-plus. And, of course, one of those is a quarterback, Ben, which that's where you want a little bit of age and experience, especially when you got a great one like he. So we are a very young team, and the young guys have to. It's not so much us acclimating them to the team. It's more them acclimating themselves and proving that they can help us win games. And once they do, they'll be integrated into the offense. Or offense or defense, wherever they happen to play.
So Arthur Motes, linebacker, saying the D is practicing a lot quicker than last year. Why do you think that is happening? Because Keith Butler's got a year under his belt as your defensive coordinator, maybe some of the younger players getting schemes down? Yeah. I mean, again, having Dupree and Shazier, who are young, they seem to have a little experience, and Jarvis Jones has been looking like he's the leader on that defense, with all due respect to James Harrison. But why is that, do you think?
Yeah, I do believe it is. You know, it's Coach Butler's second year, and there wasn't a lot of difference in what Coach Butler believes in and what Coach LeBeau believed in. But there was changes, and it's the second year is a lot easier than the first. And then you get, you know, guys like Shazier and Bud Dupree, Stephon Tuitt. They get through it, and they, you know, they have a full off season with the program, another off season, I should say. So I do think there's less thinking and more reacting on their part. Now the rookies, they're still swimming. That's natural. That's normal. And again, they'll catch up. But you know, there will be some growing pains with those guys. But at least we have a couple more young guys to maybe pick from as we try to put the back end of the defense together.
And you talk about rookies swimming, and I've always found it intriguing in terms of, as you said, acclimating and getting into the system, because it's a wide, eye-opening experience when you get into an NFL training camp coming out of college, no matter how much experience, no matter what college you came out of, even if they're running a pro-style offense and even if they have the most well-known coach in college football, it's still not professional football in the purest sense. As far as getting some of these younger guys acclimated, has it been a challenge as far as OTAs and the practices of the CBA having changed in the last year?
Yeah, it has, because we have less time to spend with the players. And that's, you know, but, you know, that's the truth. But the reality is we all have the same rules to abide by. So we have to figure out a way to best utilize the time that we get. And, you know, it's not like one team gets any more time than we do. So you can never use that as a reason. You just try to again, teach these kids, you know, about NFL football. But until they experience it, you know, all the classroom work in the world will never prepare them for what's going to happen come the fall. Every step is a new step for them. OTAs was different. You know, mini camp was different. First day in pads is different. The first preseason game is different. First regular season. So it's just a constant learning practice for these guys. And you just hope that, you know, they don't lose their confidence. And if they, you know, they find a little bit of success, you hope it builds, and you hope it builds sooner than later. But in all honesty, if you try to rush it, you may be hindering the player more than helping him.
And if you're just joining us, our guest is General Manager Kevin Colbert of the Pittsburgh Steelers. I read something, and it seems to be accurate, but you're using robots in practice? Did I read that correctly?
Well, it's not a robot per se. It's an old popsicle tackling dummy, if you know what I'm talking about. The old ones, they're about 6 foot tall. The players could hold them. You could tackle them, block them, whatever. There's a group out of Dartmouth that has perfected this, and they've actually added a robot bottom so that you can move that dummy. So, you know, you can use it in one-on-one pass rush where the dummy is actually the quarterback. And you can move it to simulate a quarterback. You can have it run routes. You can have it run with receivers. It's just now starting to come into they're probably still a year away from mass production. And it's a little bit of trial and error, but it's been something that's it's been real interesting to watch. And, you know, I think that these robotic tackling dummies probably have the same potential to our game that the jugs machine had for baseball. I think they'll be that impactful once they get it perfected. But it's been a neat little tool to work with.
Last question before we let you go, Kevin. You have an embarrassment of riches on the offensive side of the ball. Antonio Brown, who set his piece and then showed up at camp like a pro. The Martavis Bryant suspension and the Le'Veon suspension hurts. But you have such depth on offense with guys like Marcus Wheaton and Sammy Coates and Darius Hayward Bay. And as well, you got D'Angelo in the backfield. It's incredible. And you got to replace Heath Miller. And Ladarius Green, I know, hasn't been practicing. He's been working out. But talk about your offense. We know it all starts with Big Ben, and he and Todd Haley seem to be working really well together. Talk about your offense and some of the challenges and how you think it's going to shake out.
Well, I mean, you know, we do have some pretty good players on the offensive side. You know, the offensive line is stable, and we'll get Marquise Pouncey back. We have a good competition at left tackle between Alejandro Villanueva and Ryan Harris, who comes over from Denver. Other than that, the other four are set, and they've been working well together. Of course, to keep Ben upright. Of course, we have a franchise quarterback who I still believe is in the prime of his career. We have a special receiver and a special runner, and then some nice guys to complement. And you know, it's our job to, if we get dealt, you know, suspension, it's our job to make the most of it. And, you know, and Mr. Rooney says this, or taught us this a long time ago, you can never give your team a reason to lose. And that's something that sticks with Coach Tomlin and myself. And last year when we had some injuries, but, you know, it's just our job to make the most of it.
Well, it seems like you've done that the last few years. It looks like you're set to have another good season. Good luck with that, and thank you for being on the program, Kevin. It's always a pleasure.
All right, Joe, you take care now.
Kevin Colbert, general manager of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Again, perennial Super Bowl contenders. We're going to take a break. Come back, hour number three, Brendan Rooney from Canada's Olympic 4x100 bronze medal winning team, and more of your Blue Jay calls and thoughts when we return on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.